For those of you that don't know me, I'm Bill Simpkins. I'm better known for my exploits in the snack bar. I'm also a geologist and soon to start a job with the Bureau of Economic Geology in Austin, Texas. Tonight, I'm going to talk to you about glaciers, and somebody suggested to me that the title Glaciers in Our Lives was something about our big traumas and something. That's not what it is. We're going to be talking about ice tonight. Okay, and I realize that the title was rather tacky in some respects. Some of you may have been expecting a soap opera or something, glaciers in our lives, but that's not on the docket either. I chose the title because glaciers probably at least as much and probably more than any geologic phenomena that has occurred has influenced most everyone that is sitting in this room. Those of us who are from the Midwest may or may not realize that most of the land that you sit on is a product of glaciations at least several times in the geologic past, probably during the last 2 million years. And those of us that are in Holden Village have the glaciers to thank for a large amount of this just gorgeous scenery around here. And it is because of that gorgeous scenery and a lot of other things that I came out to Holden myself. And I would like to at least try to relate and try to explain some of the things that you may be seeing while you're out here. Okay, so glaciers in our lives. Glaciers may have affected us indirectly or directly and may affect us in the future. And for a brief period here, I'd like to do a little dramatic reading. Satellite photos gave the first warning. In 1971, seasonal snow cover in the northern hemisphere began on Labor Day, almost 2 weeks earlier than usual. Snow accumulated during the winter in record amounts and persisted in snowbanks through late July of the following year. The pattern of early snow and late melting continued. By August 1982, snow and sea ice covered 15 million square kilometers. For that time of year, an increase of 10% in just one decade. That summer, fishing boats remained icebound along the entire coast of Iceland. The grain harvest in the mid-continent was the worst in 50 years. By the eve of the 21st century, large permanent snowfields were established in many parts of Canada. Tidal gauge readings in Boston Harbor on July 4, 2026, indicated that mean sea level was 10 centimeters lower than it had been in the bicentennial year of the United States, 1976. The new ice age arrived earlier than climatologists had predicted. That's kind of a doomsday approach. Yet when we look at it, glaciers may also be a part of our future, and I think it would behoove us to know a little bit more about them. So, tonight, we will learn about glaciers. Most of us think of glaciers as kind of large blocks that just kind of, I don't know, float along the rock or whatever. Oh, maybe I should ask you. Anybody here want to volunteer what they think a glacier is? I will take anything here. When the word glacier comes to mind, what immediately comes to your mind? Anybody? River of ice. River of ice, okay. Anything else? Okay. Slow moving. Okay. Crevasse. A lot of snow. Okay. No ice cubes in an ice tray or anything like that, huh? Snow job. Actually, that's what tonight's lecture is going to be. Okay, technically, and really there's a real fine line between a lot of definitions that we use, but technically, glacier is defined as a body of glacial ice which has shown movement presently, is now showing movement, or has shown movement in the past. Okay? Now, we have in this area and in all parts of the world permanent snow fields, small snow fields, all kinds of stuff like that, that are not technically glaciers. And in order to get a glacier, as we will see here, there are certain things that have to occur. Okay? One is the changing of snow to ice, and the other is some kind of movement. All right, let's investigate the first part. Up here on the board, for those of you that haven't seen a water molecule for a while, this is it. Some of you may know that water is known as H2O. That means that there's two atoms of hydrogen, one atom of oxygen. It's usually arranged in a configuration like this. Large oxygen here, and from now on the oxygens will be not colored in and the hydrogens will be colored. Okay, when we think of water, that is the molecule H2O in its liquid state. And this thing just kind of swims around all over the place. Isn't connected to anything, is really free. Okay? Ice, however, is more structured, and it is the same molecule except that it's bonded. Okay? And this is what we call the solid state. This is a side view of what ice looks like when these molecules come together. If we look at it from the top, what we would see is the ordering or the symmetry that we see in a snowflake. Most of you have seen snowflakes. They're six-sided. And this is characteristic of what this would look like if we had a bunch of molecules all together and we're looking down on them. Here we're looking at a side view. Okay? The structure of ice does not change. We see snowflakes. We see an ice cube coming out of a tray. It still has that snowflake structure, except that it's masked by different a rearrangement of the grains. Okay, now let's look at this next chart. Let's assume we have a place where snow is going to accumulate. Okay, now a gentleman over here said that when he thinks of a glacier, he thinks of lots of snow, and actually that's very true. Snow starts out with a very low density. Density, for some of you that are unfamiliar with it, is the weight that's carried by a particular volume of that substance. Water has a density of 1 gram per cubic centimeter. Snow, when it falls, is 1/10 of that. That means 1/10 of a gram. It weighs 1/10, 1 cubic centimeter of that weighs 1/10 of a gram. Now, as snow falls on snow, snow on snow, sounds like a hymn. Okay, snow on snow, we get a progressive compaction of the snow, and it changes and gets more dense. It goes to corn snow. Now, most of us have seen corn snow. You ski on corn snow lots of times when there's been a melting period. You also see it along the sides of roads when the snow plows have come along and it's sit there for a while and melted. More snow. More snow on top of this. More compaction. The crystals get closer and closer together. And finally, we reach a point where the density is 0.55. That's called fern. All right, or neve as it is in French. This is the last point where this moving around of grains occur. Past this point, we get a lot of other stuff going on. And finally, when you get down to ice, we're talking about densities of 0.917. This is the process that every glacier must go through in order to get glacial ice. It starts as snow, and layer upon layer is added until the sheer weight of the overlying material compacts it, and we go into ice. Okay, well, that's nice. You know, why am I starting this lecture about snow on snow on snow, and what does this have to do with anything? Well, the point is that when we look at glaciers, most of us think of a very large mass of ice, and we don't think of these tiny individual crystals that make it up. The next diagram will demonstrate this. These are these water molecules as they first, or these ice molecules as they just first form. They're chaotic. They fall wherever they may, and as you can see here, they have a variety of configurations. Surprisingly enough, when enough of these have come together and we have that compaction down to glacial ice, all these crystals orient themselves in this manner. If we would look through the bottom layer of an ice sheet, we would see, well, we wouldn't see them because they're really small, but if we could look at them through a microscope, or electron microscope, we would see this configuration here. This is what's called easy glide. And in easy glide position, what happens is that as the ice begins to move, because these bonds, which are the weakest, move from one crystal to the next. Okay? So, what happens is we have tiny molecules, billions of them, in an ice mass, and it is the imperceptible movement of each of these little ice crystals that makes that entire mass move. Okay? That was the point of starting at this molecular level. I find it particularly fascinating that we can have an ice sheet that takes over 10,000s of square kilometers, which can be controlled by the indiscriminate movements of these little ice crystals. Okay, that's enough of that. If we were to go out on a glacier then, and by and large, we would probably see this. This is a mountain here, this black stuff here. A glacier is characterized by a couple different areas. One is the area where the snow accumulates. This is at the front of the glacier, the top. The other is the area where the snow, or the ice, as it now becomes, melts off. Where the amount coming in equals the amount coming off, this word is ablation, it's the same as melting or wastage or something like that, is the equilibrium position. That means that you have equal amounts of both occurring at this line. This is a gigantic conveyor belt, if you can think of it in this way. What happens is that every drop of snow or ice that starts up on this end is eventually moved to this end and is melted off. Okay? It just is a continual cycle. Conveyor belt. Snow is accumulated. You get a fresh snow up here. It moves down, is compacted, changes to ice, moves out. Okay? Now, when we think of advance or retreat of a glacier, what we want to look at then is if the amount is coming in is equal to the amount that's going out. It's kind of like your budget in some ways. Not my budget. Mine always goes out more than comes in. The glacier will advance if the amount coming in is more than the amount that's melted off. It will retreat when the amount coming off is more than what's coming in. Okay? The important thing to note here, when we think of glacial retreat, and I'm not sure some of you are familiar with these terms, but when we think of retreating glaciers, say the glacier retreated from Lake Chelan up the Holden Valley, okay? Before I knew very much about this subject, I just thought the glacier kind of put it in reverse gear, you know, and turned around and went back that way. That's not the way it is. What happens is that you get less and less stuff coming in at the top so that the front is melting back faster than this can supply it. And in that way, the front moves back, the glacier loses mass and gets smaller. Okay? Now, how fast do glaciers move? We've been talking about a lot of movement here. I suspect, and somebody asked me this today, if you would go up on Lyman Glacier, you would not be able to detect a whole lot of movement. Some of the smaller glaciers probably are in the order of centimeters a year, meters a year, something like that. Some of the larger ones are up to hundreds of meters a year. That's all because of these little ice crystals moving along each other and this whole movement this way. A glacier also slides along its bed if there is enough water present at the base. But by and large, movement occurs because of the deformation in this area here. Okay, glaciers can also surge or gallop, as they call it. And when this happens, you will get glaciers that move several kilometers in a couple months. This is when you get worried about where you're going to build your house. You would not want to build your house next to one of these. Okay, well, this is the theory, and this is all your theory you're going to get tonight. This is probably the most technical part of glacial geology, and in fact is called glaciology, which is the study of physics and chemistry of ice. People spend their lives crunching ice together to see what these crystals will do. Want to see where science is really at these days. I find it interesting. I didn't spend my years in graduate school doing it, but it does help you understand what those little blocks of ice up there are in the hills. Okay. Now, there's another concept I want to get across, and then we'll look at some slides. Glaciers are gigantic erosion mechanisms. Now, erosion is just the removal of material where it has been before, whether it is physical, the breaking of rocks, the removal of rocks by streams, etc. Okay, there are two ways that a glacier does this. One is that sometimes it will melt in certain areas along its base, and you will get incorporated into it large blocks and very small particles from the base. And at this point, they refreeze on, and what you have is a gigantic sanding block that is going down a valley like this. And you can imagine, well, sandpaper has a certain life, but time that you can use it. But these things are very tremendous erosion mechanisms. Some of you may have seen, if you've been out to New England or some parts of the Midwest, you will see large boulders sticking out of nowhere, and you will see them just like somebody took a gigantic claw and clawed along them. Those are called striations. And striations are caused when something like this moves over a very soft rock surface and just scours out little tracks along it. Okay? That's one mechanism. The other way, it can just take whole blocks from the rock that's around here and just incorporate it right into the ice by the same freezing mechanism. All right? Also, if you're in an area of mountain glaciers, you can get stuff that's broken off these peaks and put down into it. All right? Debris that's shed up here and moves through the glacier and eventually ends up down here. Okay. Now, some of the most spectacular features of glacial erosion are found right here in Holden Village, if you can believe that. We're very fortunate. Mountainous areas that have been glaciated show just very nice features that show how this erosion takes place. So I think, without further talking around, we'll turn on. This is the Antarctic ice sheet. I would like to thank Becky and Jim, too, for letting me use these slides. I did not come real prepared to give a demonstration on this, so I had to borrow what I could. This shot just gives you kind of an overall view of what an area that has been extensively glaciated by mountain glaciers looks like. And I should say at this point that when we talk about glaciers in this area, we're talking about those glaciers that start in the valleys and primarily do their stuff in the valleys. Many of you are probably more familiar with the larger ice masses that covered Minnesota, Wisconsin, Illinois, and we'll talk about those in a few minutes. Okay, the snow line on this area is very clear too. This is, you can see where the snow, and the point at which below the snow is melted. It doesn't take very much for glaciers to get started. If you would have a drop of temperature from between 5 and 10 degrees on an annual basis, the elevation of the snow line would decrease and you get much more accumulation of the snow in these higher altitudes. Okay, let's look at some familiar sites here. Okay, this is up around Bonanza, as I understand it. This is where the action happens as far as mountain glaciers go. If you look up in the right, the top right of the photograph, you will see a large bowl-shaped amphitheater there with some ice in it. This is a classic example of a cirque. And a cirque is an area where you have had snow fields that have accumulated to a large amount of snow and eventually turned into ice and carved out a bowl shape like that. Okay, most of the glaciers that are in an area like Holden have started in an area like this as small snow fields, and over a period of hundreds and thousands of years have grown into glaciers. Another good example is Holden Lake, if some of you have been up there. Holden Lake is a very nice bowl-shaped amphitheater, and even though it does have a glacier above it now, I'm somewhat unsure as whether the ice really did start at this level or not. Anyway, it's a good example. If you look on the topographic map, which I'll show up later, it shows very nicely. Okay, remember that the next time you go up there. And a lake inside of a cirque is called a tarn. Okay, when you get a large amount of these cirques forming at higher elevations, they tend to cut back on both sides of the ridge. And what you end up with is a series of knife-like ridges, which are called arêtes. This is a beautiful picture of an arête, and you can see it's just very jagged, it's very steep, and that's a real nice photograph. Here's another shot. Okay, let's look at some more familiar photographs. The valley that Holden Village is in is, of course, the Railroad Creek Valley, and if you trace that valley all the way up, it ends about where Lyman Glacier is. And not having talked to very many people, I guess it's my probable opinion that the most of the ice in the valley was probably from Lyman Glacier, when Lyman Glacier was much bigger. All right, and also that this glacier was fed by many other smaller glaciers, one of which comes out of Copper Basin, one of which comes out of Holden Lake. This is Lyman Lake here, and if you will look on a topographic map later, you might see that there are a series of lakes that come down this valley. And those are technically called Paternoster lakes and are due to the scouring action of the glacial ice as it moved down the valley and its deepening effect on some of these little basins here. We'll point that out a little later. Okay, now if we move on down the valley, this is Hart Lake. Notice the characteristic U-shaped valley that a glacier produces. If you were in a mountainous area like this anywhere else and there was no glaciation, the valleys would be much more V-shaped. Some of them do not have this classic U-shape, however. This is looking down on the village from Bonanza, and although the photo is pretty hazy, you can see in the lower left is Holden Lake. And if you can imagine that entire valley in the background there, with 3,000 to 3,500 feet of ice in it, and being fed by a little glacier that comes off of Holden Lake. Okay, now the more ice you have, the more erosion you have, and so the deeper valleys had more ice in them. And as we go towards Lake Chelan, you will see that the valleys, well, finally at Lake Chelan, the valley gets 1,500 feet deep. Okay, now this is looking down on the village from Martin's Ridge. Now what I want to point out here is a classic example of a hanging valley. Copper Basin, in the background there, probably had a much smaller glacier in it than did Railroad Creek, which is in the foreground here. Okay, Railroad Creek glacier cut down much more, was more erosive. The smaller glacier was not as erosive. However, the smaller glacier flowed out into the main valley, and when the ice left, that valley was left hanging over the main valley. Okay, let's look at a couple more, and I think you can see this. You can imagine smaller little glaciers coming out of these feeder valleys here into the main valley in which Holden Village sits. Here's another shot. Illustrates the U shape very nicely there. And you could just imagine that, just a river of ice in there coming down right into the Railroad Creek. And finally, when we get down all the way towards Chelan, or Lake Chelan, I should say, this valley carried the major portion of the ice that came out of the Cascades. And this is, as I said, 1,500 feet deep in spots. Just the remaining couple minutes here, hold up a map of the United States. Can I get a hand here? And point out a few things. Okay. Now the glaciers that we've been talking about were primarily mountain glaciers that occurred up here. Okay. Mountain glaciers have also occurred many other places in the West, namely in the Rockies, the mountain ranges in Wyoming, Utah. All these areas that were of very high elevation contained mountain glaciers during the last ice age, or what we call the last 2.5 million years. What also happened during the last 2.5 million years is that large masses of ice formed up here in Hudson Bay and up here along the western coast of the United States. These masses fed little lobes of glaciers, I guess I would say, finger-like projections that came down into an area like this. Now, I'm not sure how many of you realize this. You know that the glaciers came down, but I don't know how many of you know that they came down as far as southern Indiana, southern Illinois, came down through Missouri, eastern part of Kansas, Nebraska, South Dakota, North Dakota, and also came along a belt into Montana. Small lobe of ice came down through Spokane, came out on the down by Chelan also. One came down here. Okay, now, these glaciers form mostly depositional features or glacial deposits. And to these, we owe much gratitude, I think, because it is these ice masses that have given us the better part of our soil in the Midwest. Many of you have heard the term glacial till, perhaps, or moraine, or some of these other terms that describe deposits that are left by a glacier, especially in the Midwest. In an area in the Midwest, glacial till covers most of this area and is overlain by a material that's called loess. Loess is a windblown deposit that is made up of silt and clay. And when you get a deposit of glacial till overlain by a deposit of loess, you have a very good soil. And for this reason, most of our corn and our wheat is developed in this area, some in North and South Dakota, some in Minnesota, because of these large deposits of loess. Okay. There's a couple other things I'd like to point out here, too. And although I cannot go into the technicalities of what this ice did, the glacier also affected many other areas besides the areas that were directly inundated by ice.
sea level dropped 130 meters
during the last ice age, and sea level will no doubt rise, or will rise again, if our ice would totally melt. In fact, if all the ice in the world would totally melt, sea level would probably be about the middle of North Carolina. No doubt there would be a large migration of the species westward.
Where would it be on the West Coast?
Where would it be on the West? I'm not sure where it would be on the West Coast. I don't think the West Coast has got to worry about it, though, because I think the San Andreas Fault will take care of you before. We also have the glaciers to thank for giving us the Great Lakes. And if some of you didn't know about these were probably pre-existing streams that the glacier from this area came down and gouged out at different times in the past. The other thing that's interesting to note is large areas that were depressed or weighted down by this 3,000 meters of ice, if you can imagine that much ice, are now rebounding up from that. The crust of the earth was depressed like this. I can show that. And it is now just coming back. And in fact, they have problems up around Hudson Bay because this area is just keeps lifting, and as it does, the rocks shift and everything else. So as a final note here, I would just like to add that although glaciation has been a big part of my life the last 3 years, it should also be a very big part of your life. And it has affected your life at Holden. And for those of you that will be going out on hikes this week, I would strongly suggest that you take along one of these topographic maps that you can buy in the hike house and look at the features. And if you need somebody to interpret them, people in the hike house can interpret the maps, right? Or you can come and see me. This map shows just very nice glacial features, and I think it really would be a shame if you would go up in some of these valleys and not realize why they are the way they are, okay? And finally, I would say that if any of you are wondering about when the next ice age is going to come, don't worry about it because nobody really knows.